Going Linux, episode 234, listener feedback. Welcome to the Going Linux podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy.
And I'm your co-host, Bill.
Whether you are new to Linux, upgrading from Windows to Linux, or just thinking about moving to Linux, this podcast will help you with valuable information and advice that will help you in going Linux.
We hope that you find this and all our episodes helpful in learning about Linux and its applications and using them to get things done. In today's episode, listener feedback.
If you want to send us feedback, our email address is goinglinux@gmail.com. And our voicemail line is 1-904-468-7889.
Hello, Larry.
Hello, Bill. Welcome back to another exciting episode of Going Linux.
Yes. would I get thrown off when I tell you I'm not actually running Linux right now? I'm actually running PCBSD, which is based on FreeBSD. They come out with a new version. It's version 10. So me being the ever-jumping distro hopper that I am, I had to give it a whirl.
Okay, so how's it going?
It actually found my NVIDIA card and installed the drivers. All right. And since my machine has multiple cores and more than 4 gigs of RAM, it says, hey, we recommend it use ZFS. And I'm like, oh, cool, because I want to play with some of the snapshots that's available. You know, you can take a snapshot, and if you bork your machine, which I'm apt to do, you can roll it back.
All right.
But I was just thinking, I've heard that ZFS, they're trying to get ZFS on Linux.
Yeah.
Do you know what the status is on that?
I don't. I really don't. I haven't been following that. I haven't been following any file format news at all. I mean, I listen to the news, but it's not something that has interested me or I have any particular reason for learning about at this point.
I like ZFS. It runs good on the machine. Mm-hmm. I got it installed on one of my spare hard drives that I put in my machine. It runs great.
Great.
I haven't played with a lot of the advanced features, but I'm looking forward to trying it. But I just wondered if it's similar to Butter or the ButterFS file system that, you know, that's in Linux. I don't know why we can't use ZFS. I guess it's a licensing issue.
I really don't know. I know that ButterFS and ZFS are both kinds of file formats or file systems that are a little more advanced than the EXT file format. It seems to come standard on most Linux systems. It's got some additional features, but I really haven't dug into what those are, so I can't comment whether they're similar or how they're different, or any of those other things that you might be interested in. So maybe it's up to you, Bill, since you now have a ZFS machine, to take a look at it. Have you tried out ButterFS at all?
When I was playing with OpenSUSE, because that comes standard.
I thought you had, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't do a lot of playing with it. I think it has a snapshot ability, too. I really need to give that another whirl. But after I get done playing with the PCBSD, I might load OpenSUSE again and see how the ButterFS works. But we'll see. I mean, I think they're similar. We'll just have to see what features are.
So maybe somebody from our Google Plus community or one of our listeners who knows a little bit more about this could send us an email or a voicemail or an audio file or something just describing what the differences are from their perspective and what they know about it. I'm sure somebody out there has a comment they can make.
Yeah. And then another thing I've been doing is my Chrome has just been a dog. And I'm like, I wonder what's going on. So I didn't have Firefox installed, so I installed Firefox to see what the latest version was, and it was so much faster. And I'm just trying to figure out what's going on. I looked at the extensions. I don't have many installed on Chrome. Have you noticed any slowdown?
No, not at all. In fact, I've been installing Chrome on just about everything these days, and I've been using Chrome, not Chromium, on Linux. I was using Chromium for quite a long time, and it doesn't have all the extensions and all of the apps that Chrome does. And now that I have a Chromebook, I want to use some of those. So I've been installing Chrome, and I've noticed that it is significantly faster than Firefox. It's slightly faster, I think, than even Chromium. I'm not sure why that would be, since they're on the same base, but it seems to be. And I actually have more extensions installed in Chrome than I've ever had on Chromium. And certainly those same extensions, some of them are available for Firefox, and the ones that are, I have installed there because I do use both browsers. But just the performance of Chrome versus Firefox, the speed of the browser itself once it's up and running is faster, but just the amount of time it takes to open the application is enough to make me continue to use Chrome rather than Firefox. So I've actually moved just about all of my bookmarks and things over from Firefox to Chrome. And I just have so many on Firefox that I'm judiciously moving them over rather than, you know, moving them over in bulk and having a bunch of stuff on Chrome that I never use either. You know, I use Firefox for all the bookmarks that I never use.
Yeah, I've noticed that I live in the my browser, and I never shut the browser. Like, for instance, I have Chrome and Firefox running right now, and each one has like 6 to 8 to 10, 12 different tabs open. And I just, right, and for some reason, Firefox seems to be running a little better, but I don't know if it's just my machine has been running for a while, so I haven't really restarted it. I'm going to see about restart and see if that fixes it. Chrome auto updates by itself.
Right.
So I don't know if it's just a fluke or I need to uninstall and reinstall.
Well, if you haven't restarted it, that might cause some slowdowns there, especially if there are multiple versions of things that it's trying to wade through. You know, the extension that's running versus the one you've installed but not yet activated, because it requires a restart. So the two things that I've noticed on browsers that cause slowdowns are number of extensions, and as you said, you really don't have too many, but the other thing is a large number of tabs. So if you're you know, try when you restart, I know on Firefox and on Chrome as well, I believe you can set it so that when you restart, it opens all your tabs again.
Yeah.
And I would create that as kind of a, it's not called a restore point on the browser, but there's a way to, you know, make a backup of your last session and the previous session to that. So what you might want to try is just restart with nothing, you know, one tab, and see how the performance is. Add the same additional tab in both browsers and see if it's the number of tabs that's causing the problem. And then you can go back to the previous session, restore that, and now you've got all your tabs back open again. But at least that might give you an idea of whether it's the number of open tabs that's causing the problem or maybe something else you want to look at.
Yeah, well, you know, just one last thing about it. I opened my system monitor to see what my memory usage was, and it was only about 2.5 gigs of, you know, I have 8 gigs on this machine, and it was only using 2.5, wasn't using any swap, so I didn't see any you know, plenty of free memory. So you know, it could be just I haven't restarted and I have a lot of stuff, or, you know, programs might just get a little wonky. So I'll try it and just see what it comes. But, you know, all in all, Firefox is nice. It seems to have a few new features. And so, you know, worst case scenario, I had to use Firefox for a little bit. But anyway, let's move on to our first voicemail. Okay. And it comes from Cody. And Cody, we're sorry it has taken us 3 months to get your message on the show.
Yeah, we really apologize. That's my fault.
Well, you could blame me. It's okay.
Okay, it's Bill's fault.
It's my fault. Anyway, he has a unique idea about how to get started in Linux. And so let's listen to it and see what he recommends.
Okay.
Hey, guys. This is Cody from Southern California. I just listened to the last podcast about dual booting and wanted to provide some input. One of the things that I did when I first got into Linux was searched Craigslist and found a guy that was selling a reasonably spec'd desktop computer tower for $40. So I purchased that $40 machine and basically blew it up. I installed several different types of Linux. I played around with it and left my day-to-day laptop alone until I got to the point where I was able to load and install operating systems on that desktop computer with full confidence, and I didn't have to worry about whether or not I was doing the wrong thing and going to screw up my day-to-day machine. So my advice is, if you're considering this and you've got a day-to-day machine that you don't want to lose yet, spend the 30 to 50 bucks on a test machine and blow it up. Do whatever you want with it until you get to a point where you feel good, and then make the switch. At least it worked for me. And since then, I've loaded Linux on multiple machines, and I've built computers for friends and family. But it all started with that confidence of being able to blow up a machine I didn't really care about. Thanks a lot for the show. Appreciate it, you guys. Keep it up, and we'll talk to you later. Bye.
Thanks, Cody. That was great.
Yeah, Cody, that's a unique idea. And that's not a bad idea, getting a older machine and just using it to learn how to install and play with it and blow it up without messing up your main system. I'm sure most of us have done something like that. I have a couple different machines that I'm always messing with. But yeah, that's not a bad idea. I know from experience that Linux is not as hard as it used to be to install.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, the installers these days are pretty smart. They're pretty good about setting up the dual booting and stuff. So I know Mint's good, and Ubuntu, of course. And I know PC Linux OS is pretty good. I'm not too sure about OpenSUSE, but I would say that any of the modern distributions, they're pretty safe if you have a Windows system. That they usually can, if you follow the wizards, they're usually about 95% to usually get it right. So,
right, I would agree with that, Bill.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, Cody, thanks again.
Thanks, Cody.
So our first email is from Gus, who has some comments about software. Dear Larry and Bill, I have some feedback on the recent episode about business software solutions. I have found that my favorite torrent client for Linux is Deluge Torrent, which I originally found when I used Pingai OS. This client is written in Python, and I have heard that it has similar features and a similar look and feel to KTorrent and to Windows clients like uTorrent and BitTorrent. I think some might prefer Deluge to KTorrent because it does not have the KDE dependencies and bloat for those running a GTK-based desktop environment. However, I have heard some say that Deluge is a little slower because it is written in Python. I find it very nice torrent program, but transmission is great for more lightweight needs. Also, I have found that the MyPaint package is great for use with my Bamboo graphics tablet. It is a great replacement to the copy of Autodesk Sketchpad that came with my tablet. Although Autodesk Sketchpad runs well under Wine, I like that there is a full-featured native application that fits my needs. Okay, well, Gus, thanks very much. That's a couple of additional recommendations. And I think in that episode, we mentioned that your applications might not be included. And these are some excellent examples that kind of fit that bill. Some valuable programs that you like that are a little alternative to the ones that Troy suggested. And we appreciate that. So any listener out there who has similar sorts of alternatives that you like particularly well, feel free to send them in. It's always good to know about alternatives to the applications that you particularly like and run.
Yeah, Deluge is not a bad BitTorrent. I've used it before.
Mm-hmm.
And usually transmissions installed. Sometimes I'll uninstall transmission and put Deluge on it just because I like the way it looks, but they all both work the same. I really don't know any slowdown. So it works fine for me. But anyway, moving right along, we have another email from Rich who wonders about RAM, and he writes, Larry and Bill, this may be a why do kamikaze pilots wear helmets style question, but but the rule of thumb on swap space always perplexed me. Rule of thumb states that swap space equals double the amount of RAM, i.e. the more RAM you have, the more swap space you allocate. However, since swap space is supposed to relieve the problem of too little RAM, shouldn't the rule of thumb be something like the more RAM you have, the less swap space you need? Huh.
Well, here's why you need double the RAM space. The swap space is used to store the information that's in your RAM. So if you have too little RAM for the task that you want to accomplish, it takes, let's say you have 2 gigabytes of RAM, and the tasks you need require 4. Well, what's going to happen as your computer runs is the things that are in RAM that your computer isn't needing right now. So let's say you're editing a video or something, and you need some RAM to be able to handle the render or handle the recording or whatever it is you're doing. Mm-hmm. And you also happen to have a browser window running, or you happen to have a file manager running. Well, you're not using either of those right now. So in RAM is the fact that perhaps you have one of these files open, it's remembering the place for the file, it's remembering what the status of the file is in the file manager. And then over on the browser, it may be actually refreshing the page automatically or performing some other functions that actually aren't really all that critical. So those specific examples may not be particularly well chosen, but bear with me. This is kind of the idea of how RAM swapping works as opposed to accurate specific examples here. So so since you're really needing the RAM to manage the video editing that you're doing, your computer is going to say, well, you haven't touched this file in a while, and you're not really using this browser. So let's take all that information that we're storing for when you actually move to the browser or to the file manager, and let's take it out of RAM and let's store it on the swap space. And we'll come back to it if you actually go over and click on the browser, and we'll bring that piece back into RAM because you'll need it then, but we don't need it now. So let's put it there. And then what it does is it clears that RAM space so that your video editing can have more RAM available for it. Now, think about this. You have 2 gigabytes of RAM. If you took everything that's in RAM and put it over on the swap space because you're doing something that needs the full 2 gigabytes or more, you're going to have at least the 2 gigabytes on your swap space to hold that information. But what happens if your computer, when you're doing the video editing, actually requires 4 gigabytes of RAM and you've only got 2? And so in addition to storing the information about the browser and the file manager, it's going to try to store some information about the video editing that you're not using so that it can free up additional RAM space for the task that you're actually running in the video editor. So it's going to store the information about which files you have open that you're editing and that kind of stuff. And it puts those into the swap space and frees up that portion of RAM for the render. Let's say that's what it needs the RAM for. So you actually need more space than you have RAM in your computer to handle those kinds of tasks. And the rule of thumb is there so that you can have about twice as much swap space file than you have RAM, so that you can store about twice as much information as you have available RAM in the swap space so that it continually can swap in and out as needed. And then when you close the video editor and you go back to your browser and your file manager, it'll just remove the stuff from the swap space, put it back in RAM, and you're back running again. And it's that transfer, that shuffle of information between the RAM and the swap space that can cause your computer to run a little more slowly, especially for RAM-intensive processes. And as a result, if you can actually get more RAM, it doesn't have to go through all that, and then you your computer will run a little bit faster when you're doing RAM intensive processes like that. And of course, if you get, let's say, 8 gigabytes of RAM, if you are doing something that uses all the 8 gigabytes, then you're going to need 8 gigabytes worth of swap space. But that's where the judgment call comes in, and that's why it's a rule of thumb. If you've got 8 gigabytes of RAM and you do nothing more than browse the internet and check email, you can probably reduce the swap space down to less than what you actually have RAM available. Probably not recommended, but you could. So it really depends on how much RAM you have, how much you're using your computer with RAM-intensive tasks. And the rule of thumb, I think, is well stated that you do need at least as much RAM, at least as much swap space as you have RAM, and twice as much if your computer actually uses the swap space on a regular basis.
Yeah, I just let the installer default what size they want. Usually it's double mm-hmm. what my RAM usage is, and I've never had an issue. When I was first starting with Linux, I didn't know about the swap space, and I didn't make a swap space once, and of course back then the machines didn't have a lot of memory, and so I was running it and it ran out of memory. And that's interesting because it just dies.
Yeah. It can't do anything more.
It's like, I'm done. So I couldn't figure out. And after learning, putting that swap space, yes, you're going to have a performance hit as it writes to the hard drive because the hard drive is not as fast as your physical RAM, but you have that space that it can, shuffle. The operating system can shuffle all that information around and keep your system running, because when it runs out of RAM or it can't write anything to a hard drive or can't move anything out, the system's pretty smart about managing resources, then it just dies. So that's why, double your system RAM is usually a good rule of thumb. And if you really think about it, it's not that much. As far as hard drives get bigger, it's really that much off your hard drive. So right. I wouldn't worry about it. I would just let it default to what it wants and not worry about it. Because I mean, I understand if it was like taking 100 gigs, but it's usually 4 or 5 gigs, 12 gigs at the most.
Yeah. Right. And my little laptop has 8 gigabytes of RAM, and my swap space, even though I'm running an SSD drive, mm-hmm. I still have swap space, and I have 8 gigabytes of swap space, so it's equal to my RAM. And I've reduced the swappiness setting, and we've covered that in the show, how you can reduce your swappiness setting. Just check out the article on how to set up your SSD drive, and we have information in there on how to do that, or listen to the episode on that. And so I've reduced the swappiness setting down so that it's pretty low. And the reason I've done that, of course, is because you don't want to be writing to the SSD drive any more than you really have to preserve its lifetime. And I have a Conky system monitor running all the time. And right now, What am I running? I'm running Skype. I'm running Skype call recorder. I've got 4 tabs open in Chrome. I've got the sound settings running. And I've got Audacity recording. I've got some other things running in the background. I've got a couple of Chrome extensions running, probably 4 Chrome extensions. I've got, what else? Dropbox. I've got the Synergy that shares keyboards and mice between computers. I've got
the base system.
Yeah, the screen capture program, Shutter. So I've got that running, and I actually have Remina running so that I can do VNC sessions between machines. So I've got a lot of stuff running here, and right now I'm using 2 of my 8 gigabytes of RAM and 0 swap space, even with all that stuff running. So wow. Yeah, it's swap space is mainly there for handling really RAM intensive processes, but you can tell from what I'm doing here there's not a lot of RAM stuff going on, and the thing that's using most of the CPU processing, most of the RAM right now, is Audacity and Skype, because Skype is yeah. using stuff, you know.
Yeah, Skype likes RAM. It yeah. does.
Yep, absolutely. All right, so Rich, hopefully that gives you some background, and everyone else that is listening in here, some background on RAM and swap and why you need it. All right. Our next email is from Al, who has a print sharing problem. Let's see if we can help him out. Hi, Larry and Bill, Going Linux. Thanks for your outstanding podcast. Over the years, I have learned how to use Linux to do almost everything I need on my Mint Linux laptop. I try to do more as I listen to your podcast. My latest thank you is for your mention of Synergy in the podcast. I now can share my mouse and keyboard between the two machines, cutting down on the clutter and confusion. I'm now trying to set up remote printing over my wireless network. I've watched your screencast on printing and searched the internet and manuals on how to do it. It seems simple with either Cups or Samba, but I can't get it to work. I'm trying to print from a laptop to a desktop, both running Linux Mint 14. The Cups version number is 1.6.1. I've made sure latest updates have been run on both Linux systems using the Mint Update Manager. I know there is a newer version of Cups, but it doesn't update when I run the manager, and I'm not sure it would make the difference. The printer is a Samsung ML1210 laser. I've made sure Firewall D is off. Below is the system information from the laptop I'm trying to print from. The desktop has a printer connected to it. The printer works when I print from the desktop. It is connected by a USB cable. I've checked that the laptop also does print when I've plugged the USB cable into the laptop rather than the desktop. I've included the desktop computer system info, the Cups error log, and the Cups config file. I've configured the laptop as a client using the localhost :631 Cups interface, and the desktop is a print server using the same method. I've also checked it is using the system config printer GUI, and they both seem to have all the sharing and visibility options checked that the manuals indicate. In the Cups error log, you can see that after I changed the client printer configuration to use the IP address of the server, the error changed to "the printer is not responding." Help! Sincerely, Cups Conundrum in Boise, Idaho, Al. Okay, have you had experience with this kind of thing, Bill?
No. I haven't. I usually just plug the printer into my Linux machine, and it's always found it. I got a Canon, and it seems that it finds drivers and installs. So I don't know about that. So he says that it will print if you hook it directly to the laptop, right?
Right, he does, by USB.
Okay, so what he's trying to do is he's trying to send the print command from the laptop to the desktop, which has the printer connected.
Yep.
But did he say that he sees that the file is making it to the desktop? I mean, is it actually getting to the desktop?
Yeah, I don't think he said that. And given the level of detail he's gone through, I'm sure that he... after configuring using localhost 631, he actually is printing to the printer connected by the network. So he's using it as a network connected printer. Mm-hmm. It's just hosted on that other machine. So I suspect that the print file is making at least to the other computer, and the error message he's getting is that the printer is not responding. So,
maybe the way it's formatted,
the way what is formatted,
the what he's trying to print, could it be a format problem?
I would suspect that he's already tried printing the same file in both cases. That may be the issue, but I doubt it. He seems pretty competent in what he's tried already, and he seems to be following the instructions pretty clearly. I don't think it's the connection. It might be the cups configuration. I need to dig into those error logs a little bit more to see if I can figure it out. But given the fact that it's actually printing when connected by USB to both computers, I think it's probably a configuration error in cups, or maybe it's a network issue. The good news is he's using the IP address and not the dot local that you can use when trying to print over the network. Sometimes when you're trying to connect to another machine over the network, if the system isn't configured properly, and I've noticed on Linux Mint prior to 16, they had some issues around that. And I don't know whether they were Mint generated issues or whether they were CUPS generated issues. But in 16, those errors seem to be fixed in the system.
It says using 14.
Yeah. So
that might be the problem.
There might be an issue there. So you might want to try, just try booting to a Mint 16 live CD. Connect to the printer using that. Connect to the other machine and try using that method. See if it fixes it. And if it does, then you might want to just upgrade to 16 rather than mess around with trying to figure out what the problem is. Of course, if you're doing this in order to learn how to configure things properly, you want to keep bashing away at it until you learn what the issue is. But you've been doing that for a while now, and I suspect that you just want to be able to print something. So try the live CD. That'll see if Mint 16 has the fix for the problem. And if it does, then do the upgrade. If it doesn't, then we'll see if we can power our way through some of the error logs and try to figure out what's going on here. As I said, it's probably either a network issue or a CUPS configuration error. Quite honestly, I can't see it being a CUPS configuration error with the detail you've gone through, but it's still possible. Yeah. Might be a network thing.
I think the amount of detail he's went through, I'm almost positive that he would have found a configuration error.
Yeah, I would think so.
But so, yeah.
Let's see. Yeah. We'll dig in. Let's hear back from you, Al, once you try the live DVD or the live USB boot and install the printer and see if that fixes it.
Yeah. Good luck, Al.
Yeah.
Okay. Our next email comes from Kevin, and he has a comment about our year-end show.
Okay.
He writes, "Good show, and I hardly approve of the three organizations you mentioned as deserving of support. I also support all three of them with monthly donations. Regards." Those are good organizations. They do a lot for the Linux community. And I don't know, Larry, do you support any of those?
Occasionally I will toss a few coins their way. I haven't done that with Jonathan's group yet, but that's something that I think I'm overdue for. So, Jonathan, I'll do something for you. And what I want to be able to do is more than just monetary support. I want to be able to help out with the development of Sonar, even if it's with documentation or something. I've just had a lot of stuff going on right now that doesn't give me enough time to do that and do a show and go to work. A lot of stuff going on at work. And once that lightens up a little bit, and I find that I actually have some time to dedicate to this, it's my intention to provide my support hands-on rather than monetarily. So,
well, and if he needs someone to just break his distribution, I'm all for it.
Oh, yeah, you can do that. Yeah, you can do that without even trying.
Yeah, I guess so.
You probably don't even have to install it on your machine to break it,
I can
it,
just
right?
look at it.
Yeah.
And it just goes, oh, no.
Not no. Bill.
Not him. No, stay away.
Yeah.
I have
taken a look at that that font for dyslexics. Have you looked at that?
Mm-mm.
Open Dyslexic. That's an interesting font. I showed it to my wife, and she said, I can't read that. So she's not dyslexic. Anyway, gotta take a look at it.
I will.
Yeah, I think it's opendyslexic.org or something like that. I
they have a font for dyslexic people. Huh.
Yes, they do. And if it makes it easier to read stuff, maybe you too are dyslexic. And Jonathan has installed it on Sonar because he wants Sonar to be a Linux distribution for anyone with any kind of disability, and then you just turn on whatever accessibility you want, and that's one of the things that's pre-installed. But Open Dyslexic is a font that you can download. It's open source, of course, and so you could install it today on your system. And you know what? We'll find out what exactly the URL is, and we'll include that in the show notes in case we have any dyslexics in our audience that would benefit from such a font.
All right.
So our final email is from Kelly, who asks about media playback in Mint 16. Kelly writes, "Hi guys, I have a Sony Vaio laptop with an i3, 4 gigabytes of RAM, and a 500 gigabyte hard drive. I dual boot Windows 7 and Mint 16. Everything, even function keys and trackpad, work great in Linux. I would like to get rid of Windows altogether, but I need to be able to play Blu-rays and DVDs in Linux. As a matter of fact, I generally have problems with media in Linux, as I bought a batch of audiobooks I can't seem to put on my phone from Linux. I was hoping maybe you had a show on media playback in Linux, or would be able to, or would be willing to do one. If I could watch my movies while I am parked and listen to my audiobooks while I am driving on the road in my 18-wheeler, when I'm not listening to your show, of course, I would be eternally grateful. I love your show, and I love Linux. Thanks. P.S. You inspired me to make a blog. It's nothing special, just my reviews and editorials. I am also putting my original music and adventures in trucking on there, too. I am using Blogger and Mint 16. And his blog can be reached at roadkell.com, roadkell.com. Thanks again, Kelly. So we'll include a link to Kelly's blog in the show notes as well. So Kelly, dual booting and audio and video playback. Well, since you're using Mint, everything should pretty much be installed, including the ability to play back videos, even commercial videos. The DRM might still get you in the end. If it's got DRM on it that there's no way around, like maybe some of those audiobooks, if you purchase them from Audible or somewhere else, it may just be impossible to play them because they're proprietary format and you require the proprietary player from the proprietary software company to play their proprietary content. See the theme there? So anyway, that may be the possibility. If you can tell us where you got the audiobooks, maybe we can determine whether or not that is the issue. I know at some point in the past, Bill, when I was using Ubuntu in particular, I had to install the ability to play back commercial DVDs. And I think there was it wasn't CSS, it was something like that that was a package, but I think on Mint it's installed by default. Do you recall? I went looking for it yesterday and I couldn't find it anymore.
I think if you install the restricted extras.
Yeah. In Ubuntu, yeah.
In Ubuntu, it will install it. But I found I did a Google search and I found a Ubuntu page, and I'll include it in the show notes, but it's at help.ubuntu.com, community restricted formats, Blu-ray and HD DVDs. And they talk about how to get it to run in Ubuntu. And since Mint is based on Ubuntu, it should work for both.
Okay.
But I do have a question. What version of Ubuntu is Mint 16 based on?
It would be, hang on, let me check. I forgot now. I think it's 13.10. Okay. Cinnamon release notes. Here we go. Google is your friend. Linux Mint is based on Ubuntu, is what I put in the search, and the first comes back with Linux Mint 16 is based on Ubuntu 13.10.
Okay, so you're right.
Yeah.
So when you're doing your research, just remember if you're using the Ubuntu forums, just remember that the version that you want to ask about is 13.10. Because there's little differences in the versions.
Right, exactly. And I also have a link that we'll include in the show notes to a Linux Mint topic about playing commercial DVDs on Linux that might help you out as well. So between those two, I'm sure you'll be able to figure it out, Kelly. And if not, let us know. Okay. So I think that's it for our emails and voicemails for this time. And our next episode will be Computer America number 70. And if you haven't been listening to the Computer America shows lately, give them a listen. They've improved a lot. We're in a lot more detail, a lot more depth than we have been in the past. And thanks to Craig's co-host, Charles Tendell, who is a actual Linux user, as opposed to Craig, who is a, at best, Linux dabbler. So we can get into more depth with Charles, and we do, and it makes for a more interesting show, I think. Until that episode, please go to our website at goinglinux.com for articles and show notes, as well as links to downloads and how to subscribe. We are the website for computer users who just want to use Linux to get things done.
And if you'd like, you can participate directly with our friendly and helpful community members by joining the discussion in our Going Linux podcast Google Plus community.
Until next time, thanks for listening.
73.
Theme music provided by Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com.